A new allocation of aid from Washington to Kyiv.
In this case, it's funding to refurbish some air defense missiles. It's going to go to pay for some refurbished tanks and also to buy some more of the Phoenix Ghost drones that have been very effective for Ukraine.
Plus, we'll hear how Iran and Russia are connected in the conflict.
Iran acknowledged for the first time on Saturday that it had supplied Russia with drones.
And later in the program, a look at Antony Blinken's trip to the G7 conference in Germany. Today is Monday, November 7th. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine.
Good evening. I'm Steve Miller.
And I'm Steve Karish. Russia continues to face heavy losses in Ukraine and is preparing new assaults on Ukrainian energy infrastructure. The Reuters news agency's Zachary Goldman takes it from here.
Russian forces are suffering heavy losses amid an assault in Ukraine's eastern Donetsk region. That's according to Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky on Sunday. Who, in his nightly address, warned that Russia may be concentrating its forces for renewed attacks on Ukraine's energy infrastructure. Zelensky's warning comes as the nine-month war may be entering a period of stalemate as winter weather sets in. Ukrainian forces in the southern front have been tightening their grip on the Russian-held city of Kherson, but have so far not been able to advance into that city. Following a series of military setbacks, Russian forces have increasingly targeted Ukrainian civilian infrastructure, bombarding power plants that provide electricity and heat ahead of winter. Over the weekend, the Washington Post reported that the United States is privately encouraging Kyiv to signal an openness to negotiate with Moscow. Citing unnamed sources, the newspaper said the message from American officials was not aimed at pushing Ukraine toward the negotiating table with the Russian aggressor, but a calculated move, appearing open to peace talks to maintain the support of other nations. The Post reported U.S. and Ukrainian officials acknowledged that Zelensky's ban on talks with Russian President Vladimir Putin had generated concern in parts of Europe, Africa, and Latin America, where the war's effect on the cost of food and fuel are felt most sharply. The White House National Security Council had no immediate comment on the accuracy of the report.
The United States is going to be with Ukraine for as long as it takes in this fight.
U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan said during a visit to Kyiv last week that Washington's support for Ukraine would remain, quote, unwavering and unflinching, and laying the blame for the conflict squarely on Putin.
This war could end very easily. Russia chose to start it. Russia could choose to end it by ceasing its attack on Ukraine, ceasing its occupation of Ukraine. And that's precisely what it should do from our perspective.
Zachary Goldman reports for Reuters News. Now, as we just heard, it's expected that Russia will continue focusing its attacks on civilian infrastructure, including power generating and distribution mechanisms. Ukraine has already been under scheduled power outages for more than a week. Joining us from Kyiv with more, as the country prepares for winter and the challenges of possibly being without a steady supply of electricity or water, is Anna Chernikova. And I wanted to ask you about the state of power in Ukraine, because Russia is continuing to hit these civilian infrastructure sites. And Kyiv's mayor actually said that he's urging people to contemplate leaving the capital city should it, you know, lose power and water as things progress in the war. So what is the current state of affairs there in the capital of Ukraine?
Well, situation is difficult, but it is controlled. And this is the main message that both local Kyiv authorities are sending to Ukrainians and to Kyiv citizens in particular, and also President Zelensky himself. So for the moment, what I can say that yesterday, during his evening speech, President Zelensky said that as of Sunday evening, more than 4.5 million consumers were disconnected from the electricity supply in Ukraine, and most of them in Kyiv and Kyiv region. However, he also said that situation is under control for the moment, and he also said that this stabilization power outages will continue in Kyiv and also in six other regions that suffered the most from Russian attacks on the energy infrastructure. Also, President Zelensky mentioned that the government is getting ready for new massive attacks, and these attacks are expected to be targeting, again, energy infrastructure. And President Zelensky mentioned that, in particularly, this is a sign for this is that actually Russian Federation ordered additional Iranian missiles, and according to the Ukrainian intelligence, they have already received those. So for the moment, this is kind of situation that outages continue. I can say from my own experience that during the weekend, there were less outages in the city of Kyiv than during the week. So on Saturday, my district didn't experience outages, while yesterday it was only one outage instead of three. Today, we already had two outages, and one more is expected. So, well, it is difficult. It is risky, of course, but for the moment, it is controlled. The mayor of Kyiv, Vitaly Klitschko, said that Kyiv is getting ready for the worst-case scenario in case there is no electricity, water supply, and telecom connection. He announced the creation of around 1,000 warm-up points around the city, basically huge tents where people can come and warm up. And also he said that in case this worst-case scenario happen, the local government will organize the evacuation of around 3 million people from Kyiv in order to, again, stabilize the situation and make it easier for people. He also encouraged people, those citizens of Kyiv who have a chance to go to the countryside of Kyiv, to do so if this worst-case scenario actually comes to life. However, he highlighted that for the moment, as of yesterday, it's no reason for panic, and it's no reason to consider that worst-case scenario would happen. But again, this, you know, these messages are in the air, and these talks are in the air. So I should say that Ukraine is getting ready for the worst-case scenario, but hopes for a better scenario to come to life.
Anna, as you mentioned, Ukraine is bracing for further attacks on civilian infrastructure, focusing on energy, power stations, distribution networks, perhaps even other aspects that would allow people to obtain water. But what's taking place along the front lines? Because there are still areas that are heavily fought over.
So situation at the front lines remain very active over the weekend. What I can say that if we look at the east, heavy battles are going on. Again, it was no particular changes in the frontline outlines. However, we have reports from the Ukrainian general staff that a lot of Russian manpower were killed during the latest battle in the Luhansk region. Again, we cannot clarify this information for the moment and confirm it independently. However, we also seen this coming from Russian sources. So, and here we're talking about people who, so manpower, Russian manpower that were recently mobilized to this war. What I can say about Kherson region and South frontline, what we see is that Ukrainian forces continue their preparation for further advances closer to Kherson. The city of Kherson, as we know, Russian forces in the city of Kherson are getting ready for the defense. We also hear that actually this huge battle for Kherson might be coming soon. Again, we don't have any dates or any details, but this is for sure that Kherson would be the main spotlight for the next months, and we will hear soon some details. At least this is what we get from Ukrainian authorities. President Zelensky announced recently that good news for Ukrainians are coming. So again, we will continue to keep our eye on that.
Anna Chernikova reports for us from Kyiv, Ukraine. Anna, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you, Steve.
Iran acknowledged for the first time on Saturday that it had supplied Moscow with drones, but said they were sent before the war in Ukraine, where Russia has used them to target power stations and civilian infrastructure. Reuters reporter Olivia Chan is up next.
Iran acknowledged for the first time on Saturday that it had supplied Russia with drones, but said they were sent a few months before Moscow's forces invaded Ukraine. Speaking at a summit in Tehran, Iran's foreign minister denied Tehran was continuing to supply drones. In recent weeks, Ukraine has reported a surge in drone attacks on civilian infrastructure, notably targeting power stations and dams, using Iranian-made drones. Russia, which calls its invasion a special military operation, denies its forces have used Iranian drones to attack Ukraine. The European Union and Britain have sanctioned Iran over drone deliveries to Russia.
Reuters' Olivia Chan reporting. The United States has announced an additional $400 million in additional security assistance for Ukraine on Friday afternoon. Jeff Selden is VOA's national security correspondent. Late last week, the U.S. announced more financial aid to Ukraine. Can you tell us how much and what it's for?
Sure. So late in the week, the U.S. came out and announced that it was giving Ukraine another $400 million in what it called a security assistance as part of the Ukraine Security Assistance Initiative. So this is money that is going to be coming as funding. It's going to go to U.S. contractors so that they can acquire more weapons, more supplies for the Ukrainian military. In this case, it's funding to refurbish some air defense missiles. It's going to go to pay for some refurbished tanks and also to buy some more of the Phoenix Ghost drones that have been very effective for Ukraine, some boats, more ammo, tactical gear, and that sort of thing. So this, with this latest package, it brings the total amount of money that the U.S. has provided in security assistance to about almost $19 billion. And of that, about $10 billion has come in direct aid in terms of stuff that's going directly to the Ukrainians. And then the rest is part of this assistance package, which goes to buy gear that will eventually get to the Ukrainian military.
That kind of leads to my next question, that this is a different funding mechanism than it's been in the past. Why does that matter?
Well, the U.S. is trying to help Ukraine in two ways. And what defense officials have said, what military officials have said, is that it's important to help the Ukrainian military now. So when you hear about presidential drawdown authority, a lot of that material has come from stuff that the U.S. and also from allies, as part of the larger picture, already have in stock. These are weapons that exist, that are made, and are simply being delivered to the Ukrainians. The other part, the Security Assistance Initiative money, is money where the U.S. is basically going out and saying, look, we have stuff in stock, but the Ukrainian military is going to need more material, more supplies, more weapons, more systems over the long term, and that doesn't exist yet. So let's take this pot of money, go out to the manufacturers of these weapon systems, contract it so that these weapon systems will be in production, will be coming down the pike, and they then can be, whether it's a matter of months or sometimes longer for some of the more complex weapon systems, can be delivered to the Ukrainian military, whether it helps in the fight right now that Ukraine's engaged in against Russia, or to help secure Ukraine down the line, perhaps even after the current war is over.
So planning for the future.
Exactly.
Changing gears a little bit, in a related story, Russian businessman Yevgeny Prigozhin has admitted to interfering in American elections. Why might Russia want to interfere with elections, and what would it mean for the midterms coming up?
Well, a lot of questions in there, so let's break it down. So first of all, Russia, according to the U.S. intelligence community, according to a bipartisan report by the U.S. Senate Intelligence Committee and many others, has been meddling in U.S. elections going back to 2016. Various people have been sanctioned for this activity, including Prigozhin, who's also known as Putin's chef. He's got his hand in a bunch of media companies. He's also known because he's the guy in charge of the Wagner paramilitary group, which has been active in Syria, it's been active in Africa, and is now playing a major role in Russia's war in Ukraine. In what the Russian disinformation campaigns and influence operations consistently aim to do is divide America and create chaos.
So trying to turn the tide of American public opinion against Ukraine, perhaps.
That's also part of what Russia has done. And there was a recent report by the cybersecurity firm Recorded Future. And what they found is that a lot of the election related activities that Russian trolls and others were taking. And many of these accounts, according to the report, had been re-energized, reactivated after having been dormant for months or in some cases years, have been working on also creating doubt about U.S. policy with regard to Ukraine and pushing, and in some cases, some of the efforts have been pushing candidates or who are less favorable to sending aid to Ukraine, or in some cases, the activities have been aimed at denigrating candidates who have been supportive of the U.S. support for Ukraine as it has gone so far.
Jeff Selden is national security correspondent for The Voice of America. Jeff, thanks for your time.
My pleasure.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Miller. The Kimberley Process is a certification program for diamonds created in 2003 to prevent the sale of conflict diamonds. Russia's diamonds, however, escaped censure for the second time this year. This comes after a meeting of diamond industry players in Botswana failed to put the matter on the agenda. The European Union had led calls to classify Russia's gems as conflict diamonds. Imkondisi Dube has this update.
In June, a stormy Kimberley Process intersessional meeting failed to discuss the status of Russia's diamonds in the wake of the country's invasion of Ukraine. Meeting in Botswana's capital, some members of the Kimberley Process wanted Russia, a leading producer of diamonds, suspended from trading in what the body deemed to be conflict gems. Fresh attempts led by the EU to classify Russia's diamonds as conflict gems fell flat in Haboroni. Belgian-based diamond expert Hans Mekate says it's unfortunate the Kimberley Process is failing to reform.
The consensus system in the Kimberley Process makes it too easy for just a small minority to hold everyone hostage, and the consensus model is really being abused to veto discussions and to veto any progress. And the problem, of course, is that status quo is not just status quo, with the challenges growing ever larger and the world around the KP evolving, a status quo actually means a digression, and that is really in this world that is bypassing the Kimberley Process.
For an item to be on the agenda at the Kimberley Process plenary, all participants must be in agreement. However, some members objected to the discussion of the Russia issue in Haboroni. Smiso Mlev, the spokesperson of the Kimberley Process Civil Society Coalition, says such matters can only be resolved if there are reforms.
They are solving today's problems using a solution which was set up 20 years ago. We have had the reform cycle before as the Kimberley Process, but it's unfortunate that that reform cycle came to an end without any meaningful progress having been made during that cycle.
Botswana President Mokgweetsi Masisi acknowledged the challenges of leading the diamond body amid Russia's invasion of Ukraine.
I also wish to acknowledge and thank you, all of you, for the support that you have rendered us to successfully carry out the duties of chairing the KP during the current challenging socio-economic political landscape.
Today, Zimbabwe assumed the Kimberley Process chairmanship for the next 12 months. For VOA, this is Mkondisi Dube in Haboroni, Botswana.
VOA senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain discusses U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken's G7 visit with Michael Kimmage, a professor of history at Catholic University of America in Washington and a senior associate with the Center for Strategic and International Studies via Zoom.
Where do you think things stand? We hear now that Russia may be on the verge of losing the strategic city of Kherson. Where do you think things stand now in the war?
Well, it is true that since the major gains in September for the Ukrainian army around Kharkiv in the western region of Ukraine, that Ukraine has continued to advance, but in the last couple of weeks, rather slowly. So it's not quite a stalemate, but there are continuing Ukrainian gains in the east. And Kherson, exactly as you say, is sort of the major question at the moment. There have been reports in the last 48 hours of Russian signs and symbols being withdrawn from the city of Kherson. The flag has come down from an administrative building, but you know, Ukraine has said that this could be a feint, this could be a ruse, and there could be kind of hand-to-hand street fighting in the weeks to come. What one has to assume is that Russia will try to impose costs on Ukraine for taking parts of Kherson. But if one had to make a prediction at the moment, I think that the prediction would be that the Russians will lose Kherson at some point.
Of course, it's quite notable that Blinken's visit comes as the German chancellor is in Beijing. Can you talk a little about that, please?
This is truly a complicated story, and I think this might be one area where Secretary Blinken brings a bit of criticism to Germany with him, that Chancellor Scholz is right now in Beijing, and on the one hand, he has really something to be sort of proud of at the moment, in that China today just released some statements about the need to end the war, and saying that any kind of nuclear use is categorically unacceptable. So that's going to be very welcome to Washington, and is, you know, just sort of good news. Generally, you could say that that's a deliverable on the German side for this meeting, but there's also a port deal that's going forward where China is going to buy a part of a port in Germany. And there are just a lot of open questions about how critical Scholz is going to be and whether Scholz is going to wind back some of the economic relationship between Germany and China, you know, for the sake of a more robust, perhaps more confrontational posture toward China. So I think that there's a bit of a dance going on here between Berlin and Washington, where Washington is not wishing to show any disagreement or tension between Germany in an open fashion, but at the same time trying to exert pressure on Germany not to be, in Washington's eyes, as naive about China as Germany had been about Russia prior to the war.
Right, Michael, as I'm sure you're aware, some observers are saying, you know, Germany put way too many eggs in the Russia basket as far as its energy and economic success. And now there's a danger, you know, what if China, invades Taiwan or, you know, strikes somehow militarily? Do you think that's a valid concern?
I think it's very valid, although these are not in any sense identical countries. And certainly for Germany, Russia is much closer and Ukraine is much closer. And, you know, there are ways in which Russia affects European life that don't map on perfectly to China's role in the world. But there are comparable issues. The mistake that Germany made in the past was to assume that economic interdependence would lead to greater peace, to greater cooperation, you know, to greater agreement on big issues of security and politics, and that proved to be basically 100% wrong in the case of Russia. Yes, there was greater interdependence between the German and the Russian economies, but what came out at the end of it was the war in Ukraine. That was not a consequence of economic interdependence, but the interdependence didn't block Russia from doing what it has been doing in Ukraine over the last 8-9 months. I think that Germany has rethought that set of expectations, and certainly Scholz has addressed that. And, you know, there's really an effort to be more skeptical and to be more suspicious in a sense where China is concerned. But it's again, still an open question whether Germany can sort of pull back and whether it can truly integrate its security concerns with its economic concerns. The tendency of German chancellors going back to Merkel and to Gerhard Schröder before Angela Merkel, the tendency of German chancellors was really to put economics on the front burner and to put security questions on the back burner. I think it's probably still Scholz's tendency with China, and we'll see how well it serves him in the coming months and years.
Michael Kimmage is with the Center for Strategic and International Studies, as well as Catholic University of America in Washington. He was speaking to VOA's Cindy Sain. And that's going to do it for us today. Be sure to stay up to date with our continuing coverage on Ukraine, as well as news and events from around the world. You can do so 24 hours a day at voanews.com. On behalf of Steve Karish and our entire Flashpoint Ukraine team, thank you for listening. Until next time, I'm VOA's Steve Miller. Be well, be safe, and good night.
This is the voice of America. Washington, D.C.